there you go.
Take me out there for a minute.
When you do the webinar every month, you start to memorize the...
I don't have a horrible, preference on where we start. Did anyone have a preference on starting with looking at the two strands we have, or if they're wanting to look at the confirmation bias idea first? They want to feel like they had a strong opinion?
Did anyone else look at confirmation bias papers? A lot of them?
Honestly, today, if I'm being completely honest, I tried to look at some stuff today and got a little frustrated because there was a couple of good articles that looked interesting and I couldn't get a hold of them because of library issues. One, like, I put the citation on Google Groups, but it said that we couldn't get it because it was published within the last year. It was in, like, the Journal of Learning Science or something. And then there was another one. I just couldn't find a copy of it. I looked at another one, and I've been trying to read it for, like, the last half an hour, and wow, is it complicated. They were looking at correlations. I'll try to give you, it was one of the ones that was listed. I think, Jackie, are you the one that put the whole bibliography up?
Yeah, that's probably one that I think I said this might be kind of a high level.
Yeah, it's called The Dark Side of Self-Affirmation, Confirmation Bias, and Illusory Correlation in Response to Threatening Information.
Wow.
So, yeah. The first study, I still can't make heads or tails. They had, like, two different studies within this thing. And then the second one, I've been trying to make heads or tails of. And basically, they were looking at, they had groups of students come in. And they had them identify themselves as, they had them take a questionnaire as to whether they were high individualistic people or low individualistic people. And what they were trying to do was they had this correlation table as to whether if you're highly individualistic, you fail at romantic relationships versus not fail at romantic relationships. And then if you're a low individualistic person, whether you fail at romantic relationships versus not fail at romantic relationships. And basically they had this two-way table that they would then give them that was, and they changed it for each person. And so they had, I think, four different groups where basically if they were a high individualistic person, they gave some people the table that would basically say, okay, you're going to fail at romantic relationships. And then they gave some of those people a table that said, no, you won't fail at romantic relationships. So it was supposed to be a threatening result versus a non-threatening result. And then they gave the low individualistic people a table that basically said, yes, you'll fail at a romantic relationship versus not fail at a romantic relationship. So does everybody follow me so far?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so they had this two-way table where the numbers worked out in such a way, and then they gave these four groups these results. And so they were trying to see whether if somebody got a threatening, what they called a threatening result versus a non-threatening result, if that would affect how they interpreted the results. And that's still where I'm trying to get some understanding. And I think basically I'll try to read you participants who tested threatening hypotheses exhibited the confirmation bias less frequent. All right, okay. I'm sorry. Hold on. Assessed correlation more accurately than participants who tested non-threatening hypotheses. So does that make sense? Or not? So basically, it sounds like they're saying that people who had results that threatened, that basically said they were going to fail at romantic relationships, basically assessed it, they exhibited confirmation bias less frequently than the people who were getting results that said they would not fail at romantic relationships, or that whatever level they were at, they were going to do well in romantic relationships, and so they exhibited confirmation bias. Did you follow that at all?
Vaguely.
So if they were exhibiting, I guess if they're exhibiting a result that said that they were going to do well at romantic relationships, they did interpret, they exhibited some confirmation bias. But if they exhibited a result contrary to what they would have wanted to see, they were less likely to exhibit confirmation bias. That's what I'm getting from this article. But as I said, it was really complicated to understand.
What I looked at in confirmation bias, and I looked at some stuff a while ago, but my understanding was of confirmation bias was that it was basically your likeliness to seek out information that confirmed what you already believed. So I would almost take it in that study as, you know, if you believed you were, if you were predisposed to believe you were going to be bad at a romantic relationship, you would accept the threatening information and discount the non-threatening information. Whereas if you were, you know, or vice versa, if you thought you would do well, then you would accept the non-threatening information and you would discount the threatening information. That was my take on what confirmation bias was, although I was really kind of just looking for a precursory, you know, what is this thing, trying to wrap my head around it. And my thought with that is, you know, I think where this came up was we were talking about context and how students may be more likely to believe a study result if it's a context they're familiar with and it already supports their current beliefs. Whereas, so I was looking at it, you know, we were looking at it as when we present studies to students, is the context going to distract them from the statistical issues? Are they going to discount the statistical issues because they were expecting something to work out a particular way and the study didn't work out the way they thought, so they're going to pick apart the study or they're not going to believe what the study says, but they would be maybe willing to believe a bad study because it was consistent with what they already thought. Whereas in my mind, confirmation bias, separate from that, was more active seeking on the participant. So I wasn't really sure if it would work in a classroom setting where we're giving them all the examples versus making them go out and look for information.
Yeah, the little I have read about the confirmation bias, it seems, you know, it's close to the idea of what we're doing, but I think it is, you know, a little bit different enough that I don't think it's exactly the same thing that we're looking for. So, I mean, it's kind of like one of those, you know, if you believe this, you're going to find everyone that tries to agree with you, and that's what it seems like what the confirmation bias is doing, is only looking at the opinions and data that supports what you already believe versus we've just presented it to you, and do you believe it or not kind of idea.
By the way, hello, I'm here. It's Holly Lynn. Didn't want to make you think that I was just eavesdropping. Is everybody else here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we just got started talking about the confirmation bias that Bob Delmas had suggested or had kind of thrown out that we could look into. So I don't, what do you guys think? Does that then, so it seems like Jackie and I kind of feel like this may not be, at least at this point, may not be something for us to pursue. Tara and Lee, what do you guys think?
Well, given my experience, and granted, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time on it, but given my experience today, it's a little more complicated than I was.
Yeah.
Did he point you guys to a specific paper that at least talked about it?
No, he just said when we were in our last phone call, when we were describing kind of our conceptual stand, and we talked, I had talked about a little bit of work Jennifer Kaplan had done with belief bias.
Oh, yeah.
He said that we could also look into something, or we might want to look into something called confirmation bias.
Yeah, there was. There was an article I was trying to find, and I don't know if it was on the list that Jackie had or if I found it under Eric. It was like, what is confirmation bias, and how do you know if people have it? That was the one I couldn't find, and that was the one I wanted to try and look that, but I couldn't find it today.
Yeah, there were a couple of Hurla posts that I was trying to find and had a library issue, just like you did, Lee.
Yeah.
And I even tried on Friday, and I was having library issues. I did try a little before the conference call.
Yeah. So, but I was like, you know, what is confirmation bias, and how do you tell if someone, you know, is exhibiting it? I was like, well, that sounds like an article that would be helpful.
The one that I downloaded was Confirmation Bias, the Ubiquitous Phenomenon of Many Guises. I didn't get through the whole thing. It was 46 pages long. But the stuff that I did read, it was interesting. I thought it did a nice job giving kind of an overview. And it broke it down into specific areas. It specifically talks about it for hypothesis studies. And the stuff it does with hypothesis studies is consistent with what Hurla found. Also talks about that even if someone recognizes the possibility of other hypotheses or beliefs, and that other people may hold other beliefs, but if they're strongly committed to their position, consider the relevance of information to the other positions, and they'll try to apply it to their own belief. I thought that was interesting.
So, I mean, it sounds like that latter part that you described could be used in situations where you're giving them two different scenarios. And asking them, I'm going back to that Honda car problem. And if you believe that Toyotas are bad to begin with, then, you know, you might you might not even be willing to think about an answer that's supportive to Toyota. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it may be somewhat relevant,
and that goes with later in the article. They talk about how people sometimes see in data the patterns that they're looking for, regardless of whether the patterns are really there.
Right.
And they give some really old references, like from the 1940s and 1950s, about studies that deal with that.
Well, just because I was, like, having trouble when I was, like, trying to come up with ideas for methodology, and so especially for the contextual stuff, how would you come up with questions that even, I don't know, I guess I'm at a loss as how you would come up with questions that would identify those sorts of things, you know, when somebody has it, I don't know.
Well, then maybe on that, I pulled up on the research cluster, there was that brief synopsis of, for the strands that I kind of put out there for us to list our goals, the methodology to look at.
Yeah.
So if we wanted to maybe spend some time looking at the contextual, because maybe if we look at what we think the goal and we think the methodology is, we might have a better understanding of confirmation bias will play in or not. So it looks from reading this that we each have a slightly different understanding of the goal. And so I think if we know what really we want the goal to be, then I think we'll have a better idea if confirmation bias will be useful.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like a good idea.
I thought that the different understandings were very interesting.
And I did decide, I believe, by looking on here, that Hurla put hers in the opposite spot. So her goal and methodology where I have contextual strands would actually be below.
Oh, yeah, so. I'm looking at that now. I agree with you. I'm sorry.
Like, I think. I'm like, why are you referencing the Watson article here?
Oh, no, you are totally right. That is completely a copy and paste error on my part because I wrote it up in Word and then I copied it over. I'm going to go ahead and just flip that now. Thank you.
What happened?
It's pretty sure, but, you know, you never know.
Yeah, I made it.
Does anybody...
in a new way.
Does anybody see my stuff?
No.
Uh-uh.
I saved it. Why?
If I refresh, I see it.
Okay.
Because I just edited it, so I don't... Let me see. I don't see it in what I'm editing. Let's see what happens if I just...
Which document are you putting it in, Lee?
I put it in the briefs, and I had... Yeah, right. I was right under Hurla. And now Tara is right under Hurla.
Yeah, I can see yours.
Yeah,
I don't see Lee.
Yeah, I can't see it either.
Did you try refreshing?
Yeah, I tried refreshing. Maybe I'll log out again and log back in. It doesn't like me. All right, fine. Yeah, there was like a thing about iPod. Oh, okay. Well, they weren't very good ideas anyway, so, you know.
That's the benefit of doing it in Word and copying and pasting.
No, I actually typed. I didn't even, like, write. I really did just, like, type it right into the thing. I didn't even copy and paste.
No, I know, but with Herla, she at least has it somewhere else. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Every time I type it in Word and copy and paste it, that's when you can never see the file again, page again. So I've stopped doing that. I just type directly now.
I need to organize my thoughts in Word first.
Yeah, see, it says edit by research cluster, because that's me. You know, I never, like, version 3. Yeah, version 3 I'm on there, but then...
Mine just says current by Herla, basically, like, you know, a minute ago.
Yeah, and then version 4 and current by Herla, I'm not on there. Yeah, right, well, okay.
Yeah,
I'm on there,
but
you have to look
at version
3. Yeah, I just
looked at version 3, and then I don't see Tara's, but I see Lee's. So we have all four of ours in various places and various orders.
All
right. It's all on there somewhere.
Why doesn't you think I was shirking, you know, responsibility here? I actually did put my stuff in there. All right. Anyway. So, I'm sorry, where were we?
So now hoping that we're all on the somewhat same page. Missing information, of course. I just kind of wanted to look at, and you can tell me if you don't want to, but kind of looking to see how everyone's goals are a little bit different. Because, I mean, obviously if we're going to be doing research together, the goal has to be the same at some point. So it did look that they all kind of had, you know, something I thought sort of in common, that we were sort of looking at the idea possibly of how sampling, if they would basically question sampling possibly, based upon their prior knowledge, it kind of seemed to be rolled into most of those. But, of course, the methodology seems to be, we're all very different, it sort of looked like on that. I looked at Hurl and I both kind of said the idea of possibly, you know, ask them a multiple choice question, have like a little short answer of explaining why you picked what you did type of idea. Tara's methodology looks like it's a little bit more in-depth with actually kind of possibly having interviews to kind of get the students to explain a little bit more as well. But, of course, I have no idea what Lee's looks like.
Mine was more of a before and after kind of thing, just kind of getting an idea of what they know coming in and then how it changes over the course of an introductory statistics course. So.
That's what I wrote originally, but then it didn't really go with the other, so I changed mine. That was what I had written first.
So, yeah, I wrote, I just thought about, I don't know if anybody else saw this at USCOTS, I don't know if it was last USCOTS or the USCOTS before, Joan Garfield had done some things where she'd looked at sampling distributions and, like, what students understood coming into the course, and then she had some videos of students after they'd done the unit on sampling distribution. And they actually were, like, really confused. They, like, understood the basic ideas of sampling distribution before the course. And then they actually asked them some questions about it after they'd had the unit on sampling distributions, and they were, like, thoroughly confused, which was actually kind of distressing because you think they would have a better understanding after the unit on sampling distribution. So I don't know. That was just kind of thought that had gone through my head.
By the way, that's my 2.5-year-old in the background. He's supposed to be taking a nap. He's not doing that. So.
Well, that seems to be going well.
Yeah. So I might be going early today, actually.
Yeah, our lives are rotating around nap times, aren't they?
So, I mean, I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so, I mean, why don't you guys start with either the contextual or the sampling and see if you can, I agree, I can't remember who was speaking, it was either Jackie or Tara, about coming up with a common goal.
Well, it does seem from the ones that we have that we sort of have some, you know, same things type there to possibly build off of. And I think mine was probably more written like a, you know, actually something I could try to assess, I think, is how I was trying to write mine, because I've been working on student learning objectives way too long.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to write mine more like a student learning objective that I could actually assess. I mean, does everyone feel that we are looking at people's prior beliefs and kind of what their beliefs are kind of coming in about certain types of topics? Like if they have a topic about cars, if they already feel a certain way, that they're going to have prior belief before they even come in about me, what they expect to have happen. Do they want it to relate to sampling? And whether or not they question sampling.
I think you do need to focus it down on a particular topic. And so since the other topic that you're interested in is sampling, that seems to make sense.
I thought I heard Herla possibly say something earlier that, you know, we were possibly thinking that, you know, if the results said exactly what they thought, you know, should already be true, they're probably not going to question the sampling method whatsoever or try to pick it apart, versus if they find this to be opposite to what they think should happen, they're going to go back and kind of pick the sampling apart, maybe, you know, focus a lot more on it. So, again, that's kind of what I was thinking, but I don't know about others. And crickets chirp like in my class.
No, I think that actually sounds like a good idea. And one of the reasons why I think this is important is this actually goes back to one of the GAYS recommendations, which is to use real data. And I think the general idea behind that is it helps, you know, engage the students. It keeps them interested, and it shows the broader relevance of statistics in the everyday world. So there's two things it's doing. But one of the difficulties with that is if we really are contending a lot with this type of belief bias, for lack of a better term at this point, then the real data may be distracting them from what we're trying to teach them. And it may only be reinforcing negative notions of statistics that they have about, you know, statistics not being useful, because they're going to look and say, well, this study didn't, you know, this study didn't match my expectations, so clearly this study was flawed, and what good is statistics? You know, something along those lines. So I think looking at the intersect of context and sampling could be really important to statistics.
Well, and, I mean, if you look at all of the discussions that are written about, I mean, kind of differences and comparisons between mathematical thinking and statistical thinking, one of the, you know, foremost things that's brought about, and certainly is brought up in the GAYS report, that in statistics you should never leave the context of the data, that you need to keep the context of the data at the fore and whenever you're doing any type of data analysis. So I agree that I think that statistics as a field says context matters. The data, you know, means something in the context in which it's situated. So I agree that I think that in the particular content strand of the idea of sampling, trying to build off what others have been doing to try to make some, with a particular audience of introductory statistics folks, you know, they've had 18 plus years of real world-ish experiences to draw upon.
Yeah. Looking at Tara's entry, it looks like Tara and I actually have similar ideas for the methodology on the contextual strand. That idea of, you know, kind of fixing the concept or the statistical lesson that we're trying to demonstrate and then varying the context or vice versa. So, you know, we could have something, we could pick, I'm almost imagining something of a factorial design in a sense, although not with numbers, you know, just setting up grid cells to collect interview responses or short answer responses, but, you know, have some scenarios where it would be a context that they would, that they might have prior beliefs about, strong prior beliefs about, but it was a good sample, a good study, and then strong prior beliefs, bad study, maybe neutral prior beliefs or a different set of a different context, good study, bad study, that sort of thing. You know, have several contexts that would be strong, several, some contexts that would be more neutral, and various incarnations of study strength and weakness. So looking, tying in the sampling strand, maybe looking at those things like identifying bias, identifying like the role of sample size or those types of things.
Right. But I think one of the major issues you're going to have to grapple is how do you reliably develop a context which you think there's going to be a strong bias, you know, where there's going to be a strong preference. What's going to be the basis for picking that context?
Yeah, now, because I don't know, if you look at mine, I was having trouble with that, because I had made the suggestion of something with iPods, because, you know, I figured, okay, college students know a lot about iPods and the whole idea of, you know, drawing a playlist and that sort of thing, so they know lots about that, and they might have, you know, but I don't know, you're making a huge assumption there.
Right, right. So there may have to be something in the methodology that you're asking them some questions about their experiences and knowledge about those contexts in which you're later going to be using on your sampling.
That was sort of my goal with the idea that opinion poll at the sort of the beginning of the semester.
Oh yeah, I see that.
Their prior beliefs.
Yep.
Because that way, before they've even seen, you know, a hypothesis test or a sample, like it's kind of, you know, like on a scale of 1 to 5, how much would you agree or disagree with this statement or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Because then we could sort of feed our questions based upon which ones, you know, seem to have a really strong preference.
Right.
I mean, but I think there are also some that I would think, I guess, in my mind are obvious. I mean, I guess for a quick example of that, I always do a weight loss example, and I have a control group, you know, that does nothing differently. And then we'll have people that, you know, increase their exercise. Well, what if it showed you that if you did nothing, you lost more weight? So for most people, that would probably be, like, that's not supposed to happen, and so I guess for a few things I've always felt they're obvious, but maybe
that's something we all want to happen, though.
Yes.
That's the result we're hoping for.
Like, I'm most supposed to be like, okay, I'm going to follow this study. This is what it tells me to do. But, you know, for most people, that would be so conflicting with what you know that's kind of from all those past experiences. I don't know, like, how I would ask an opinion poll question about that, if that makes any sense.
Well, I wonder if you could, like, one thing we might be able to do as a group is identify kind of similar things that people might have a reasonable amount of knowledge about, but that might also be hot button type thing. So something with politics always generates a lot of really strong emotion. So could we, I don't know how this would work, but like, could we come up with some sort of political scenario or some sort of, gender scenario, something that evokes some sort of gender stereotype, that people might have strong beliefs one way or another about how accurate that is. Things along those lines, things that deal with, you know, like the one example they had in the Watson article that they actually decided they couldn't ask the third graders about the legalization of marijuana. So, you know, something about drugs or alcohol or things along those lines. Like, we might be able to identify a bunch of different scenarios that could elicit strong prior beliefs, and then we could use those as our basis for our opinion poll.
Mm-hmm.
And get a, and then get a better beat on our classes that way.
Yeah, I think it would make a lot of sense to just try some things out and pilot them. I think part of the fun of it is getting some of the unexpected kinds of responses, you know, things that you never would have anticipated in advance that they pick up on in the questions. So I think that does sound like a good start to me, to just actually try to write some items that sound interesting and maybe try them out in a couple of classes if you have like an assignment or at the end of a quiz or something like that. And that probably give a lot to talk about, like in terms of how to design the items.
Do you think we're going to have a problem where we're going to find, when we do an opinion poll, that we're going to have really different results, like different things are going to spark different people at our colleges because we have such diverse bodies?
Well, that could be a strength, because if you want to see if having a strong opinion on something affects the way you approach a problem, then I think you'd perhaps want to have something where some people are going to be strongly affected on it and some people aren't.
And even affected in opposite ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Like if you did have something, you know, political, and you find out that, oh, Obama's the greatest president on earth, okay, people who liked Obama in the first place, you probably expect to be like, oh, yep, that's fine. But people that dislike him, you're going to expect to have a bit more issues with it. So right now it seems like we've done a lot with the methodology part, but we've kind of ignored the goal.
Is there a problem with that?
I know I'm one of those weird people. I think usually the goal is important first before you decide the methodology.
But sometimes you have to start talking about methodology to really kind of hammer out, okay, what exactly is it that we're interested in doing? Because we all know that we think in concrete terms, and methodology tends to be more concrete.
I really like the discussion about the methodology so far.
But, yeah, I mean, I think that's a good comment, too, because sometimes it really, you know, that methodology kind of discussion can really help clarify goals and you know, it is like trying to find something that everyone is really interested in looking into. So like if you come up with questions and people think, oh, that would be really cool to ask, then that might be a way of kind of tapping into, okay, what, you know, what is really the main goal or main topic of interest for the group. So I think it's good to, you know, like you said, have some discussions about methodology too, along with the goals.
Now that we have discussed methodology a little bit, like what seems like the common threads in that seems like they may have implicitly been a goal in our discussions.
This is where the synthesizer jumps in and pulls all of the threads out, I think.
All right, well, I happen to be a synthesizer, too. All right, so my take on what we just pulled out of the discussion, if I could do a one-sentence summary of our one-sentence summaries that we were just talking about. I think we were looking, we actually did a little bit of a flip. I think up until now we've been focusing on the sampling strand, with the contextual strand being an underlying, a more underlying or a more background player, and I think we just did a little bit of a flip where we went to context with the forefront and sampling providing the context for our contextual strand. So now we're going to look at students, how students' prior beliefs about context affect their understanding of sampling methods. So that to me is the goal. To see if students have a strong prior belief, does it affect their ability to judge a sample as either a good sample or a bad sample?
Yeah.
What do you guys think of that?
That's pretty good.
Does that seem consistent with what we were talking about?
Yeah, I think you're sort of focusing on the sampling, and then I think it shifted a little bit to the focus on the contextual. So
So I think it really kind of aligns with Jackie's goal for the contextual strand.
Of course, I like your word effect better, but I very seldom ever use the word effect because I never know if it's an E or an A, and I don't like to look stupid. To be perfectly honest. I like never use that word if I don't have to. Written, anyway.
Yeah, that's the good thing about talking is it doesn't matter.
It's an E effect or okay. There's a reason I went into statistics.
Yeah.
But they might not necessarily affect them in the way that, you know, I think with the way my goal is written, I have kind of already, in a sense, my own little hypothesis, you know, kind of written here is I'm assuming it's going to do this, but it might not necessarily do that.
So we just, but we want them not just to question sampling methods. We want them to be able to recognize good, too. The way, if we say more likely to question sampling methods, that kind of has an implied that we only want them to be able to pick out the bad ones, not recognize the good ones.
I mean, I guess what I meant when I just said question is that are they going to kind of go up and pick it apart if it doesn't go with what they believe, whether it's good or bad? Which might not be obvious with the way that I phrased it.
That might be something worth, and that's actually kind of one of my fears in this, you know, talking about hypotheses. My hypothesis would be they're going to discount good research that is not consistent with their prior beliefs. And they're going to weight more heavily bad research that is associated with their prior beliefs. So this is kind of the, you know, and I think this example is out there with the idea of students taking anecdotes over randomized trials and some of the issues in that. So in a sense, you know, that's my hypothesis. And I think there's some other indication that, or I think there's some other people that share that hypothesis, so I look at that as a way, or I look at this study as a way to explore that more fully. And then maybe what could come out of that is the idea that this is something we really need to target. We really need to target with these students how to recognize good sampling methods, kind of especially in the cases when when it goes against what they're expecting.
Yeah, so you're really seeing this as a study of how they think, and then, you know, maybe some discussion about teaching strategies that address problematic thinking patterns, and then maybe even somewhere down the road, some sort of intervention study is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think that sounds good. So look to see what they think, and then address that area. Because I agree with Tara. It's easy to get, it's maybe easier to get them to pick apart the bad things, but we also want them to recognize the good.
And so I'm unfortunately a very succinct person, so I went onto the page and I tried to edit my goal a little bit to make sure it's implying what I thought I was implying. So I just kind of added, like, you know, if they were more likely to question the sampling methods, whether they were good or bad samples in the first place, if they conflict with what they believe. Like, will they pick apart a good sample more often if the results are opposite, or will they pick apart bad samples more as well if the results are opposite? Kind of idea.
Right. And it certainly sounds like, at least at this point in the conversation, that you're really having them assess these questions on, what I think you're doing is assessing results of a study that where they're trying to make a decision and they're given some of these sampling information. But we also might want questions that ask them to design, where they're trying to decide on a sampling method. I don't know if that is. So is it about questioning sampling methods or an understanding of usefulness of sampling methods? Because it's a question where they're asked to design and come up with a sampling method, you might get different information. I don't know.
So I know in our classes we don't really focus on having them design anything. It's more of, you know, here was what was done. Is it good or bad? Why? Kind of stuff. So we usually do kind of more of the reading. Can they read an article and kind of pick up, you know, the
more from a consumer's perspective.
Mm-hmm. That's how, I mean, our classes are emphasized.
Uh-huh.
I don't know about everyone else's.
Well, I wonder if one thing we could do as a follow-up to each study is, you know, have an open-ended question about what if you could redo this study, what would you change? And so it still keeps that focus on evaluating someone else, but then that's just another way to kind of triangulate, are they understanding the deeper issues in sampling?
Right.
And can they identify or can they recognize good methods and, you know how to incorporate those? That might actually be a really rich kind of, it might provide a lot of rich insight into really how they're thinking about this sampling.
Mm-hmm.
Is getting them to talk about it in their own words rather than always having them evaluate ours. So we could do both to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that sounds like a really interesting kind of a, you know, quick way to get a lot of information, just, you know, like asking them what they would do different or... And then I guess it would just be a question of, do you want to point their attention towards specific aspects of the study, or maybe just ask a more broad overarching question of what would you do differently if you were to do the study? But I think that sounds really good to me, that it would be a way to get a lot of detailed information about what they're thinking.
I agree. Can anyone articulate for me like two or three of the different sampling contexts that might be assessed here?
Apparently not.
Trying to get a handle on exactly what we're talking about, I'm feeling, you know.
Well, I guess there's like one article that I sometimes use in a class when we get to talk about this more. It was an article that ends up, like, ranking universities, kind of teaching and that type of stuff. And one of the things that they use is ratemyprofessor.com to help them figure out where things come from. So I usually bring up, like, the idea that ratemyprofessor.com is one of the worst sampling kind of methods out there, kind of things. You know, it's volunteer. People are usually strong opinionated one way or the other. So, like, if I gave them results from this, you know, in a sense, if it was about, like, maybe a teacher that they absolutely hated and everyone out there is saying that they love them, kind of idea, I guess, maybe is one quick one off the top of my head.
So I guess what I'm getting at is what sampling methods might be related to people's individual prior bias about context? Like, I thought the whole Democrat-Republican thing was really interesting, but I couldn't think of a sampling method that would relate to that particular issue.
I guess what I was thinking in those lines, or the way I've been imagining this, is for any scenario, you could have, say, a convenient sample versus a randomized poll. So you could... So maybe we would even, for the same scenario, want to kind of have paired problems that are randomized in various orders in that sense. But the idea is you could have the something like exit polls of who voted for Obama versus a randomized television poll, or not a television, like a randomized telephone poll. Or you could have, you know, we went to CNN.com and they had a poll about how do you think Obama is doing versus a Gallup poll.
Mm-hmm.
Something along those lines. So it's, both of them are under the political context, which, you know, are likely to evoke strong reactions one way or another. And one of them is based on a good sampling method, the other one's not.
Mm-hmm. So there, there's almost two priors. There's the student's understanding about sampling and their political leanings. And ideally, the polls might go in the opposite direction.
Yes. Yeah, because the way I'm thinking of this is what we would want them to base their answer to the question on. So suppose we were asking them to evaluate the polls. What I would want them to base the answer to the question on is the sampling methodology. Was it a randomized poll or was it an internet poll, a convenience sample, or a voluntary response sample? Whereas our hypothesis here is that if they did go in opposite directions, they're more likely to pick whichever method supports their beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So the students who think Obama's doing a great job are more likely to say that a poll that says Obama's doing a great job is accurate regardless of whether it was the internet poll or whether it was the Gallup poll. And vice versa.
So there it seems like you'd almost just want an open-ended question of why did you choose the poll you chose and hope that they would get at either obviously this is correct, meaning I agree with it, or get into the sampling methodology.
Yeah.
And then I still love the question about how would you change it.
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, I can think of watching like the political shows at night. I usually sometimes flip back and forth between MSNBC and Fox News because those commentators are always going after each other, which is kind of, for me anyway, fun to watch. And Bill O'Reilly is on Fox, and he always has a poll that says, 95% of the people that logged on to this poll said, they would vote for whoever. And it's, there's just practically every night there's something like that on there that, it's like, okay, let's think about that for a minute and what's really going on. So on the websites for those cable news channels too, I think there would be, it'd be really interesting to just have students, to maybe even go onto the website and look at a specific poll and a result and critique it. I think that it does sound like it's shaping up to be an interesting study. I think the only thing I can think of is like the human subjects stuff might become more complicated once you start asking political questions. You might get someone on a committee more likely to scrutinize it than if you're just asking questions about, more benign kinds of questions. But I would imagine that wouldn't be too much of a problem, but just something that you might run into.
Yeah, I think Brenda brings up a good point. I think in your IRB, you would just need to explain very clearly the purpose of the questions, so that the purpose of the study, and how important it is that context matters, and all this kind of stuff, so that they understand the point of asking such types of questions.
Would it also be interesting to look in the same survey at a different set of surveys where the sampling was different but on an issue that would be much less likely to be polarizing and see if people can focus more on the sampling in that context?
Yeah, I think that is something that would be interesting.
Yeah, I think you would need to have, whether it's on the same survey or a different survey, some questions that work, and I think somebody brought this up in their methodology, kind of neutral.
Yeah. Harrison says.
So then what's our next step from here? Should we all, before our next call, try and identify possible kind of strong prior belief context and possible neutral context? Or at least
if I can just jump in real quick, I have to go because my 2-year-old is tearing apart the bathroom and trying to drink dirty water out of cups and all. So I'll catch up with you later.
You got damage control.
Yep. Okay, talk to you later.
Bye.
My personal bias is that I really like the concreteness of these lists of possible questions, sort of ideal questions, not going out necessarily finding surveys. But I think in addition to that, continuing to work on a one-sentence statement of the goals.
Yeah, come to consensus.
Yeah.
Get your act together, ladies.
Focus on the goal and methodology, and then also start to look for questions to make sure it's feasible.
No.
Yeah, because, I mean, you don't want too far the semester to go by before you have the opportunity to do some piloting.
Yeah.
You know, you got some students there for X, you know, N minus X weeks.
I mean, if nothing else, we can at least ask, like, the opinion poll type questions and see if we are pushing buttons with some questions and not with others to make sure that the neutral ones really are neutral.
Right.
We can always continue field testing summer, too, right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we have at least 3 sections of statistics that's offered over the summer. I'm not teaching any, but I can just have the other people do the questions for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same thing with me. There's going to be, I don't know how many sections I won't be teaching, but it'll be a grad student, so they'll do what I tell them to some extent. They'll at least agree in principle. Hopefully the questions will actually be answered.
Right.
All right, then. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, what did you find out about your IRB processes?
I'm speaking for, this is Jackie, so at NKU, I've actually just went through an IRB. I've already gone through all the formal paperwork, but I already know we took all the tests and did all that kind of stuff that we have to do, so we have to actually be certified to be able to do anything with human subjects in the first place through a website.
Oh, wow.
It's like I had to take a test by reading all the past information and kind of why you have to do certain things a certain way. And then the program that I did was exempt. They didn't really have to do any scrutinization to it. But I do know here that things go through the filter pretty quick with getting feedback, that generally within a week minimum you hear, you know, feedback already. So, I mean, it's going to be pretty quick that I would hear a response at least of what they would want me to edit or expand on type stuff.
Yeah. I have a pretty unique situation here at NC State in that Roger Woodard, who's the course coordinator for our large intro course, has ongoing IRB approval. And the first thing we do in each semester is collect informed consent from the students. So basically any question that Roger agrees I can ask, which is pretty much any question I tell him I want to ask, we're more or less on the same page with these things, we can add it to an in-class activity, we can add it to an exam, we can make sure all of the instructors are getting the data, and we just have that ready to go basically whenever we need it, and it's ongoing from semester to semester. So I didn't have to do anything with IRB here. It's already in place for me. And the nice thing is then, you know, whenever we decide we want to pilot something, we could decide we wanted to pilot something next week, and we could at least start with my students here because I've already got that in place.
Do you need IRB approval for piloting?
I don't know about that. I think if it's not going to be published, then it's just something, it's just a question on your exam or an example, you know, a question in class or something along those lines.
But we were planning to share it at the JSN meetings, right?
So that might be a little...
Right. I think you need to check the specifics about IRB, Herla.
Yeah. Well,
either
way, I have it here. So if we want to just have our bases covered, I know which students have already consented to have their data analyzed. Because we're collecting the data as part of the normal part of the class.
But if you would do this as part of normal part of the class, but you'd have to give it in the context of something of a normal assignment.
Yes, but I think I can do that if we wanted to. If we wanted to get feedback on a scenario or test a question out, I can add it as an assignment or I can add it as an exam question in the course. And then we can pull the responses from those students who have given their consent.
One thing I will say that I thought was interesting, I had mentioned that we were using that Chicago gun survey question.
Mm-hmm.
And I had it on my final, as did all the other 127. That's our interest at score sections. And it was interesting because what we found was that almost as a whole, the students' responses were that Chicago's known to be dangerous, it's known to have problems, and blah, blah. So they would take the job in the other state because it's not Chicago and that it's not representative because the crime rate in Chicago is higher. And so they never actually said that the results couldn't be generalized. It was all about how using their knowledge of what they thought they knew about Chicago. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
But we don't have an IRB. Is that odd? And probably not, because we're a community college and nobody does research. But I have a guy I have to get it approved through.
Oh.
There's a guy. And I'm a little concerned because he's not the most motivated person on campus, so...
Well, I think what we would want to do is then make sure that your name is on as a collaborator on somebody else's IRB.
Okay. Yeah, I just thought that was odd because people didn't even know what it was when I emailed asking about it.
Right. So, for example, I'm involved in a research study where I have an IRB here, and I'm sending surveys to other universities for them to collect with their students. And their students sign my permission slips.
Okay.
So I would say, I mean, we can do something similar where we put you on somebody else's IRB and you use the materials that have been approved at their university.
Okay. But I'll still have to go through the guy at my university because he said I'm not allowed to do anything unless he says it's okay.
Right, probably.
But I'm not quite sure why. But that's what he told me.
It's a little bit past 5:30, and I know I have to go here in a couple minutes. Do we want to try to set a time for next time?
Yes.
Tuesday and Thursday afternoons. Still looking okay for everyone? There's a pull out a date here. I mean, if we did 4 weeks from today, that would be March 23rd.
That could work for me. Going back to the normal or to the 4 o'clock time we had originally set, because the conflict I had today is not a recurring one.
Okay.
So I could do the 23rd from 4 to 5.
That doesn't work for me, but I don't think that should stop you.
And that should work for me. This is Holly Lynn.
Works for me, Mr. Jackie.
I have the activity webinar that day, but that usually ends by, like, 3:15, so that's fine.
Could we go back to the 16th, since originally we had tried for last week, but I emailed her too late to get the time slot?
I'm actually going to be out of town on the 16th.
Okay.
No, 23rd's fine. I'm done by 3:15, so. Well, Felicity said she wouldn't be there, so.
Well, and you might want to think about, I mean, the work to be done, and do you, you know, as far as do you want to wait until the 23rd or I mean, you know, the 16th or the 9th? I guess I'm also just thinking of time frame in the semester as well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's that too.
So, yeah, so let's then clarify what we're going to be doing. Are we going to be brainstorming a list of possible contexts and possible questions?
Yeah, I have written down looking at puzzle topics and questions to be more specific, and then still trying to refine our goal and methodology.
Right. So that's something, that's the type of thing that it probably would be better just to force ourselves to do in a short period of time, because brainstorming is just a list of ideas. So what about, sorry, flipping through calendar. February throws me off because it's a short month. So the 2nd is next week, correct? So the 9th would be 2 weeks. Do you think we could do this in a 2-week time period based on other commitments and things? Based on the fact we're all completely overwhelmed with everything else going on.
I do know that week I have people in town because it's spring break.
Okay. Yeah, my spring break's the 16th. That's part of the reason I'm going to be out of town. Do we need to flip to a Thursday then?
I might need to do a different time on a Thursday.
I could do that Thursday because she'll be out of town by then.
Which Thursday?
The 11th. Yeah, I could do the 11th.
In okay. The regular 4 o'clock time slot?
For me, it would need to be before 4. I have office. I teach Thursday night, so I have office hours from 4 to 5, and then I teach from 6 to 9.
I can't do 3, but I could do 2 o'clock.
I could do 2 o'clock on Thursday.
And are we all talking Eastern?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, just making sure.
And I'm fine on at 2 o'clock.
And that works for me.
Yeah.
All right. So is that a...
Sorry, I didn't mean to, like, I mean, I'm trying not to rush you guys, but I'm just trying to think about, you know, it didn't seem like the amount of work to be done would be that overwhelming, and just to move you guys along.
Yeah.
Sorry, I have to go take off and get to daycare, so I will see you on
that. That would be me as well, so unfortunately, right, I'm going to have to go to
2 p.m. on March 11th.
All righty.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
All right.
Bye, guys.
Have a good
day. All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.